Well, how's your practice going? What should we talk about? Yes?
So I've been studying the sutras for the last few weeks, and I have a lot of questions. I'm wondering if this is an okay time to ask a sutra question, or if it's better to reserve this for practice.
Well, let's try it out. Let's see.
So, I've been largely kind of disappointed reading the sutras. It feels very much like any other religious text I've read. There's a lot of, you know, magic, Buddha being a magic guy and magic characters and support for antiquated social rules, you know, wives are subservient. There's some great stuff in there, but at least from what I've read so far, the vast majority is stuff that I don't believe in or agree with, and I'm wondering what the relationship is between the teachings of the living Buddha and what it is that we do here.
Yes, your experience, this is, I think, what happens so often when an educated Westerner who has no previous background in Buddhism decides to read the sutras. They have an experience like yours that just, there's a lot of really good stuff here, but there's a whole lot of other stuff that just, and when you think about it, not all of that stuff fits together very well. So you have to understand Buddhism became a religion, a huge religion, and it took on many forms. And each time it took on a new form, it did so by assimilating a lot of what actually belonged to some other religion. So what we get now today, those sutras, the Pali Canon, are probably, they are the closest that we have to what the Buddha actually said. But they have been extensively modified, huge sections redacted, and huge pieces added from other sources. And then if you go to other versions of the Buddhist canon, the additions and the deletions are even greater. So, as a matter of fact, one of the ways that scholars can track some of the additions and deletions is by comparing these different versions, and then it becomes quite apparent certain things that have been added or removed. So the Buddha did not start a religion. The religious aspect of Buddhism came later. And as it became religious, incorporated into it were all kinds of pre-existing religious beliefs that I think are probably where a lot of the conflicts come from. But there are parts of those teachings which are just, you know, so obviously right on that they're not problematic. And then the more experience that you have in your own practice and the more insight you acquire, then it becomes easier and easier to sort of discern, because there's the parts of those teachings which fit so well with our experience. And actually you're doing what the Buddha taught himself. He said, don't accept anything on authority, which would include scripture.
I read the Kalama Sutra and it seemed great. Yeah. And then the next 25 were not very great at all.
Right. So if you don't accept things on authority, including the fact that they're scriptural and have been revered for many centuries by all kinds of people, what basis do you accept them on? And he pointed out some very clear things. First of all, one he stresses in the Kalama Sutras is that these teachings should have a beneficial effect on you. And likewise, the actions and behaviors and speech that arise from them should be beneficial and not harmful to others. So that's one criteria. But he also said, it should make sense to you. It should make sense to you. And the other thing related to that is it should be consistent with your experience. So if you go and practice in the ways that are described, then you should have consistent results. And when something doesn't fit with that, then those are the things that you should suspect and at least set aside. There's always the possibility that something doesn't make sense to you because your own understanding is not quite adequate. So you can set it aside and maybe come back to it later. Or that something doesn't fit with your experience, that perhaps your practice hasn't developed to the point where you're going to have those kinds of experiences. But that is really the most important thing, is to use it as a guide, working very closely in conjunction with your own thinking and experience of the world, and interactions with other people and what you see happening, and then it's very effective as a guide. You know, the idea that the Pali Canon is this sacred thing that, you know, you have to accept every word of it, and many, many Buddhists, this is what they believe, does not hold up to a scholarly analysis at all. Scholars go through a sutra and they'll find a whole section which just plain doesn't fit. It's a different style. Sometimes the original Pali, you know, is grammatically different tense, different person, things like that. But the most important thing is that the ideas and instruction contained within it don't fit with everything else. And so you have to be aware of that. You have to be aware that this is, you know, this is not some divinely dispensed, absolutely pure source that you can take without a grain of salt. That being said, though, there is so much of value in that. I spent a lot of time reading the sutra. And, you know, it's a really good feeling when you read something in the sutras and it does fit with your experience and it does make sense to you. And it's an even better feeling when not only does what it's saying make sense and fit with your experience now, but it holds within it a clear direction for where you can go next, what you can explore next. That's the most wonderful thing about it at all.
Yeah, but is it going to help me get enlightenment?
It is.
Really? I'm with a couple of them suckers and was bored out of my mind.
So I had the experience that Chila Das is describing where, well, and the one you're describing where much of it was like a boring or like just patently offensive. But there were a few things that I read that really did feel like it changed my mind frame in the right direction. But yeah, percentage-wise, it was not very big, but certainly worth trudging through the rest of it.
And it's not for everyone, Tim. They're very hard to read. And because they're originally orally transmitted, there's so much repetition, you know, that it takes a lot of discipline to even get through some of them. You know, my own experience. You take some. You had something to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, I ask myself this frequently. Why am I doing this? Because it can be a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And I keep, you know, keep coming to the same answer: personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then I ask every teacher I can find, "What's the latest shortcut?"
Yeah.
Right. What do you know that will help me get there quicker? Mm-hmm. So, what do you know?
As far as a shortcut that will help you get there quicker, interesting. I've never actually thought about answering that specific question. I think, you know, when I reflect on the way I teach, a lot of it is you have to have a pretty good idea of where there is. What I try to communicate is an idea, an understanding of what the goal is, and then a map of how you get there, and then an explanation of how it is that those things about the way we are, at least most of us are as human beings, which are standing in the way of us getting there, because that's what you need to focus on. You need to understand what is not working. Why all human beings aren't automatically enlightened, right? What is there about us that's getting in the way of the understanding of the realization that will free us from suffering and make us be beings of compassion and light? Well, it is understanding. It is a wisdom. It is a knowledge. And what stands in the way of knowledge is misperception. You know, I used to teach physiology, and students would wrestle with physiological problems. They wouldn't be able to understand things. Explaining the way cell membrane potentials and action potentials work. And, you know, 80% of the class can follow me and understand it. They just have to go back and work through it a few times themselves, and then they can regurgitate it as required on an exam. And then there's the other 20% or so that just, you know, and some of them quite bright, just keep banging their head up against it over and over again, and, you know, it doesn't work for them. And whenever I would tutor those students, you know, I always knew what would happen. Sooner or later, I would find the idea, the ideas, the concept, whatever they had that was wrong, that was in the way, so they couldn't follow the understanding. And this is what gets, it's the same thing. It's the wrong ideas, it's the delusions that you have accepted as true that are keeping you from seeing things the way they really are and becoming an awakened being. So the biggest shortcut, the best shortcut is, from my point of view, is to have as clear an idea as you can of where you're going. I suppose you might put that, what it would be like to already be awakening. And what the map is, what the terrain is between here and there. And then what are the things that are holding you back and holding you down. Now, you can get that from the sutras, but you have to have a particular kind of mind, and you have to have a lot of patience. And you can get that from teachers, but you have to have a fantastically fine-tuned bullshit meter. And you can get that through practice, too, but you have to do a lot of practice, and you either have to have good guidance or a lot of luck or a combination of those. But you can use all of these things, you know, to help you get there. Second?
I'm sorry.
Do you like that answer?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I go on?
Yeah. I think so. Well, and it, yes. There are a couple of other people who want to say something. Maybe I'll listen to them and come back to you. Beth?
I just had a comment, which is that if you want something really badly, if you want to be enlightened so badly that you crave it and you search for it, isn't that in and of itself going to delay your enlightenment?
It is, at a certain point. But if you want that more than anything else, it's going to get you like 60 or 70% of the way there. Then you're going to have to start loosening up and letting go of that. But it'll, you need that to start, you know. and that's right. You cannot, well, there's no such thing as an enlightened person. You will never become enlightened. Enlightenment will occur in this psychophysical entity that you are. It will occur when the person, the attachment to self, has been set aside. Right? Now, does that, and also, the transformation that makes us be the kind of person that we want to be involves being free from every sort of craving, desire, and aversion. So does that mean that what that desiring happiness, desiring enlightenment, desiring wisdom, desiring to become a kind of wise, compassionate, loving person that you imagine, and thinking of yourself as being the one that becomes that, does that mean that that's a bad thing? No. There is a point where at which you have to give that up. But that's where you start from. And that's the only thing that's going to really get you going to the point where you get to where you have to. And if you, and as you get to that point, it's not so hard as it sounds. Because all the way along, the more you learn, the bonds that attach you to those views are being weakened throughout the process. So when the time comes to start letting them go, they're not so hard to let go of. It seems like a paradox, you know. But it's not. You have to desire enlightenment to get to the point where you can get out of the way and let go of your desire.
I have a comment to this shortcut too. When isn't it true that the experience of the process, diving into something where you open up your mind and learn different things, the whole thing, if that would not work for me, I would stop immediately. I don't care about an enlightenment, but I care if it's working during the path I'm choosing. If that path is not working, I stop it. But if it works, I don't care how long it takes. I don't care how the result is, because it works right now for me. Yeah. And isn't that the process we are in?
Yes, it is. And that's a piece of advice that I've given to a number of people over time. You know, there are so many different traditions and teachers and things like that. And people wonder whether they're following the right path. And a piece of advice I give them, it should be making your life better continuously. The more you practice it, the better your life becomes. If it's not, you might seriously question that perhaps another path would be better. So, Neil?
Meditation versus sutra study.
Meditation versus?
And then sutras, and then studying sutras.
Yeah.
Now, I always want to know what to do. Right? Mm-hmm. And my practice has been meditation.
Yeah.
And what's in the way is stability of attention. And that's the goal I have, is to increase the stability of my attention. And I don't care that much what you do after that, because I haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
And so I don't really read sutras. I don't really read too much about the steps past 3 or 4 or 5, because I have this very clear path. And for me, I guess, like Tim, like, why read the sutras? It seems like this kind of knowledge and understanding is so deep that just reading something and, now I see how I'm completely not a separate thing. I just can't see how that could be. So am I ignoring the whole set of stuff I should be spending time with?
No, not at all. But there may very well be a time where just the right thing for you to do is to read the sutras. And to qualify, I'd say, to read the right sutras, because there's so many of them, it would take forever to read them. So you need to focus on the right ones if you reach a point where that is what you need. But the practice is, I think, goes so far as to say that without the practice, you'll never be able to understand the sutras, and you'll never be able to sort the wheat from the chaff in those sutras. So to focus on the practice to begin with is absolutely the right thing to do. Some people might be, there are people who are very intellectually disposed and might prefer to study the sutras. And that's fine if studying the sutras brings them to the point where it creates in them the desire to realize the fruits of the path and to do the practice that's necessary for that to happen. But a lot of people never look at them at all. Now I'll go back to Tim.
Hey, several years ago, have you heard about Adyashanti?
Of who?
Adyashanti.
Yes, I heard about Jason.
I was living not too far from there, and so I was able to do a lot of his talks. And many times, four or five, he would ask the audience, how many people here would like enlightenment? And probably about 99% of the room would raise their hand. The other 1% didn't know whether they are or not. And then he would say, how many would like enlightenment if they knew it was going to turn their life upside down? And roughly about half would drop their hands. And that was always a puzzle to me. And I was up at Spirit Rock doing a one day with him, and he gave me one shortcut. And that shortcut was to lose control. And if you lose control, you don't have anything to fall back on. Right? There's no habit. There's no conditioning. You're just stuck in the present moment. And that became my mantra for a long time, was losing control. It doesn't stick. It's like my meditation practice helps me be mindful of when I'm not in control. When I am in control, so I can step back from that. But it doesn't stick. Mm-hmm. One day it may be fine, the next day I'm just smack dab in the middle of it again. What? Other than more sitting, okay? Mm-hmm. What would you recommend so that things like those peak things that you picked up along the path stick?
More practice, but also understanding them better. Because, you see, giving up control is a great way to have an experience which in certain respect is positive and beneficial and resembles what happens if you acquire some insight. But it's not the same thing as those. Because the very notion of giving up control assumes that there's somebody who's giving up control, and that was somebody who actually had control. And all of that's the illusion. So what you're doing is to give up control is to play a little game that can help you understand. But it's not, it's just a little game. And all it can do is to help you understand. So the only way to really give up control is to realize that you never had control to start with. And then from there to realize that there was never anybody there who could have had control anyway. And practice from that viewpoint. All of these different ways of practicing they're approaching this in different ways. Like we're taking the practice of coming to the still point. There's this place which you can find, maybe you've touched on before, and you can cultivate the ability to go to, where there is just this conscious awareness, that is totally unaffected by everything that's going on around it. And as you approach that, first you feel the stillness inside while all of this stuff's going on around there. And then what is separate from the stillness becomes the body itself. And then what's separate from the stillness becomes even the mind. And then you get to that point of this really refined stillness. Now you're on the verge of realizing the truth, that all of those things that you attach to as part of yourself, some being, some entity that could be in control or out of control, or give up control, or forget to give up control. You know, you're in a place where all of a sudden it's obvious that all of that is nonsense. So that's just there are many different practices and different methods, and all what they're all trying to do is to get you to a place where you have some experiences that put you face to face with what's always been the truth anyway, in such a way that your brain and your mind start to incorporate that. So more practice, but practice with understanding. And any practice you do works really well at a certain point, but when you reach the point that it's not doing the job anymore, then you need to question either the practice or your understanding of the practice. You may need to move to a different practice, but you may need to have a deeper understanding of how the practice is actually working.
What's a reasonable time frame on that judgment? Like, if your practice is, you know, not doing anything for a week, then it seems like that would be kind of flippant to change it. But
yeah, that's flippant.
Yeah. what do you think of as a time frame for that judgment?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to try to put a number value, like X number of days, weeks, months, things like that. But I think it sort of goes back to what I said earlier after Hannah made her comment. If it's not moving you forward, if you don't have a reasonable sense over a reasonable period of time, you know, not a week, but that it's moving you forward, then, and even, you know, some of the ways it can be moving you forward are subtle. If you find that your practice is making it easier for you to deal with difficult situations in your life and you don't even know how, that's still progress. If you find, well, you could give other examples, but there are a lot of different ways, subtle ways that your practice can provide benefits. Yeah?
Well, yeah, not so very long ago I was quite convinced that listening to you and practicing in the new ways that you've suggested were really speeding me along at great speed. And this sounds really silly, but it popped into my head about a week ago that when I really stopped and looked, not one single day of my life has gone from sunrise to sunset as I planned or expected. Not one. There's always some interjection of, oh, this wasn't what was on the list. And it might be mild or it might be severe, but it dumbfounded me that I had come all this way and only last week noticed that. And then you come up with this, if it's moving you in the right direction, that's a positive thing. And I'm looking back at, well, I'm certainly moving, but I am now completely confused. I feel confusion of, am I going in any particular direction at all? I'm going. There's no question I'm moving, but I have completely lost assurance that there is directionality to it.
Okay. I'll give you a brief answer, and then maybe we can talk about this after we do our
session. Yes.
But I never said that any day in your life would go the way you wanted and expected.
Yeah.
Rather, what I would expect to happen is that you're a lot more all right with the fact that it doesn't than you previously were. Now that's moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it was only startling that I had failed to notice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really it. I know you didn't promise that it would go as expected. Yeah. I know that. But I thought I had.
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that you didn't notice. There's something that I should point out. I've noticed this myself, and as you change, you're often not aware of how you've changed. Something will happen, and suddenly it will create the contrast between the way you are now and the way you used to be, and then you realize how much you've changed. But the new norm is just the norm. And you there's the tendency to take it for granted unless you actually reflect or unless some circumstance comes up to make you aware of the kind of changes. So it's very important to point that out. If while you're looking to see whether your practice is making improvements in your life, remember that you can't just trust the intuitive feeling that, oh, well, I've really changed a lot. You might have to look a little bit to see or do some reflection. Yes, Pat?
Just very quickly, it gets back to Tucker and what Chris was saying. You said a few minutes ago, too, and also about the control thing, that, you know, that you realize there's no one in there that's controlling, which seems to really connect with what we were just saying. Because it seems like it's like Indra's net. I mean, there's not this in here that's making the changes, that it's happening. It's like this incredible weave that's occurring that's universe-wide. And the changes that are instigated and brought into play is this incredibly large web. And as I look across my life and my friends and everything, it seems like that's the case. It's just this amazing weave. And how even coming into meditation, even choosing this path, and then the different little, what do you say, goalposts along the way, are almost not me instigated. I mean, they are, but they aren't. There's some sort of interchange happening between whatever is in here. Mm-hmm. What isn't here isn't really in here. But it's an amazing dance.
Yeah, it is.